This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for February 2010. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature some poems in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear poetry from Sam Willits.
Use, cluck, raise, score. Use, cluck, raise.
And from Martha Zweig.
I hid in the glove box, pretending to be directions.
We'll also speak with Michael Hoffman about an essay he translated for us this month by one of Germany's leading poets, Durst Grünbein.
You know, he's making himself sort of indigestible, or not easily digestible.
Kay Ryan, Robert Bly, and Clive James have poems in the February issue. We also have a long and unusual poem from Robert Haas. Right, Don?
It is unusual. Many people are familiar with Robert Haas's work through the years. This is from a forthcoming book that collects that body of work and adds a little bit to it. There's some notebook sequences in the poems collected in this forthcoming book, and this one in the February issue is called September Notebook Stories, and it's made of little bitty pieces and longer, puzzling lines of verse, and it's a strange compendium.
It ranges from straightforward stories where a man and a woman are sitting in a movie watching a car crash, and they sort of imagine it happening to themselves, to little jokes.
Jokes without punchlines.
Jokes without punchlines.
Like, three greenhorns are being measured for suits by a very large tailor on Hester Street.
To a little fragment of a ballad. He loved to watch that woman sew. She let her hair grow long for show. Riddles a needle, a refrain might go, and plainly said is thread. Which is a kind of key to the whole poem. Riddles a needle, and plainly said is thread. And what you get in this poem are a lot of riddles, and then a lot of very plain language.
Yeah, and here's a little story about the distribution of wealth, this one. Once upon a time, there was an old man and an old woman who were very, very poor.
And there's one section that is one of these narratives. It runs like this. He found that it was no good trying to tell what happened that day. Everything he said seemed fictional the moment that he said it. The rain, the scent of her hair, what she said as she was leaving, and why it was important for him to explain that the car had been parked under eucalyptus on a hillside, and how velvety and blurred the trees looked through the windshield. Not, he said, that making fictions might not be the best way of getting at it, but that nothing he said had the brute, abject, unassimilated quality of a wounding experience. The ego, in any telling, was already seeing itself as a character, and a character, he said, was exactly what he was not at that moment, even as he kept wanting to explain to someone, to whomever would listen, that she had closed the door so quietly and so firmly that the beads of rain on the side window didn't even quiver. What I love about that is it gets at the sort of absolute self-consciousness that we can't escape these days, that you can't quite be in an experience without thinking of yourself being in an experience.
Right, and what's the story there, and how do you think about it, and what kind of sense does it make? A few stanzas or sections later in the poem, there's a little part that goes like this. Why, he asked, because she was lonely and angry, said the friend who knew her better, and she'd run out of stories, or come to the one story. So the sequence really reflects how these things are woven together.
And that's dropped in the middle of the poem, not at the end where you'd expect it.
Yeah.
This month we have two poems by the British poet Sam Willits. Willits lives in a small town, Stow-on-the-Wold, about 40 miles from Oxford in southwest England.
This is the first time he's appearing in Poetry Magazine. His first collection, New Light for the Old Dark, will be published in April by Jonathan Cape Random House in London.
A few years ago, Willits got an assignment to write a couple of articles about Poland for an American travel magazine.
And I decided to use this time to try to find out what happened to my mother's extended family in Poland, something my mother never talked about.
His mother's family, who was Jewish, got split up during World War II. Some of them, including his mother, became refugees, just outrunning the German invasion.
Other relatives died on the way to, or actually in, concentration camps. Here's Sam Willits reading Tourist.
Warsaw, October. Rose Madder by 5. The soldierly grey boulevards, slippery with tickets to winter. After 40 years rebuilding, the old town is like this beautiful girl I knew, whose face got wheel broken in a crash and remade so well It was hard to say how she looked wrong. I'd brought with me, holding them, as if they might slip, two questions. Who were my mother's people? Where did they die? In an attic archive, deep card indexes, ink turned lilac with age. I handed my questions to a love labourer in a yarmulke. With sad palms and a shake of his head, he regretted that the answers now lay probably beyond our reach. So I abandoned questing and went back to tourism. I joined the passeggiata, drank black tea, got stickied under sooty lime trees, saw boisterous children, all knees and elbows, skyline capering on the wall at the river line. Beyond their frail silhouettes, against the petrol dusk, huge cranes were moving, courtly, confident, building another new Warsaw across the Vistula.
Willits told us that his efforts to find out more about his mother's family in Poland failed. He said it was like walking towards a fog. The truth, the past, kept receding as I approached it, and so he gave up. But I'm really struck in the center of the poem by the gesture or the actual reality of his handing questions to a love laborer in a yarmulke. I mean, love laborer is a very weird way to phrase the person who works in this kind of archive.
Bureaucracy.
The bureaucracy. Yeah. And of course, a few lines later, he says that the answers are out of reach. There's something about these hands, sadly, almost meeting or handing things on, handing questions with no answers on.
Makes it feel like a fortune teller or something that he's come to see.
Yeah, like a palm reader or something.
With the same kind of inscrutable hopelessness that you're left with, that you know, you get a kind of fortune that there's nothing you can do with.
It's funny because it's a sort of cerebral experience, and even his voice, you hear this, it's kind of a sad, inward-looking experience, but his eye is always attuned to the colors and shapes and figures that hover around this experience.
With the children's skyline capering, which is terrific because they're at once against the skyline, but then the gestures they make, it makes them look like a skyline, their angularities.
Right, and even the huge cranes in the skyline are moving, sort of like grown-ups, courtly, confident, and they're always building another Warsaw.
The other poem that Sam Willits has in this issue is called Digging, and he explained that title for us as well as a few other things in the poem.
Digging is a rather unlovely expression referring to injecting. There's also a phrase later on which is cluck, which refers to cold turkey.
And raise, which means raising money to score. It's about addiction.
Serious drug addiction.
Here is Sam Willits reading Digging.
Missionary Girl reports that Chinese addicts say your heart begs you to stay away even while your legs are carrying you back. After the merry little jitter of the filter with the smack dancing in the spoon, after the absorbed, assassin-like, childlike procedure, citric, water, flame, I'm back in the basement, heart-sick, digging for a vein in February, as in a February gone and a February still to come, spitting prayers through the tourniquet between my teeth, licking up tears and pleading for my blood to plume up in the barrel, please, blossom up, squid ink, blood anemone in the works, though you can have all that and miss, or pull out and find you'd had a vein, now pissing blood, Dino's words as his grey fringe smeared across his forehead, as he missed and bled and raged to get it in. Blood, thank Christ. Spit out the tie, inject the welling gratitude, that flushes pleasure through the grief, for the help and hope of friends sold out, for all her loving years, all of it driven down before one flood, one gut-bracing stealth of warmth. Ah, well, restorative as sunshine to a snake. So around the days and the seasons the junkies go. You might as well accelerate us until our days and nights are strobing by. Use, cluck, raise, score, use, cluck, raise. A lantern show flicker of tail chasing, nameless days, spent waiting, scheming, waiting, fighting to outrun the burn and freeze, and maybe worse, the waking up to all that's lost, her happiness, her younger years, the child she might have had.
That's a powerful poem.
Yeah, it is a very powerful poem.
It really is. I mean, digging is a good way to experience what's going on in this poem. You know, digging in for the vein, digging the arm, digging around in your conscience and your life, your whole life.
And I think the power comes from the extent to which the feeling is resisted. What does he call it? The stealth of warmth, one gut-bracing stealth of warmth. And you get a feeling of an addict's tremendous desire to resist the very thing that he loves the most.
Mm-hmm. Something eerie about the poem is that the language of the poem, the voice of the poem, is so much smarter than the addict. The addict is kind of dumbly going through all this stuff, use, cluck, raise, score, use, cluck, raise. And the poem seems to be reminding the poet of his own humanity at every turn. And I was very struck by the absorbed, he says, assassin-like procedure of shooting up. And that word assassin comes from hashish, you know, it's filled with this forbidden knowledge at every turn, but is trying to awaken from that back into life.
Also in the February issue, we have several poems by Martha Zweig. Zweig is the author of Monkey Lightning, which is just out from Tupelo Press.
She lives in rural Vermont, where she admits,
I'm pretty reclusive professionally, although I love to read.
The poem we're going to hear is called Whereabouts. Its sound play may make you feel a little discombobulated listening to it for the first time.
It's supposed to kind of bop you all around and to sound a little nonsensical, but then it should turn out that everything does make sense after all.
Here's Martha Zweig reading Whereabouts.
Glovebox rummages itself and dumps fuzzy cough droppings and stuck menthol. Among them, a misdirectional map intrigues me. Say, clotheslines, fripperies, hopping the breeze off the alley and garbage lids clanging downhill to the sea. Say, there in the sea, flows of penguins bobbing up to Argentine flamingos. How hard is it to get lost? Listen to lost, useless horses whinging for home and hames, a lost grail stuffed with dirt, deaf to human legends, long unstrung of sacred tune and lost. Children prodded along in the loops of war. Hopscotch mistake, the cast stone skipped off the lake instead and lost the tournament to the nice policeman there with the ice cream precinct and his body buddy, Dad. Dad declares he knows by the spit and stripe of her this is no one of his own, his kids mope, and he goes. Ear to ear, I must look lucky at last, librarian at the dictionary of things looking up ever since I hid in the glove box, pretending to be directions.
Well, as you can hear from that, she's a terrific reader. And you can also hear just how much this poem depends on its sound, how much it moves by those sounds. You know, one thing I particularly admire is the way there's nothing mellifluous or overarching or self-consciously musical about it. It's very much sort of a roughed up sound.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, when I first read it, I did feel lost. And it's true, as she says, that it does make sense in the end. I was really hooked by the second stanza where the poem asks,
"How hard is it to get lost?"
Yeah, I thought it's pretty easy, actually.
Yeah, pretty easy. And then suddenly it becomes a narrative poem. You have the sense that you're going to go all the way through this thing, and it's a crazy lyric, and all it is these sounds. And then suddenly in the last stanza, you've got,
"The cast stone skipped off the lake instead and lost the tournament to the nice policeman there with the ice cream precinct and his body buddy, Dad."
Now that's her. That's the speaker's dad,
right?
Apparently. That's
right. Right? Yeah. And the sort of dizzy car trip there in the poem where, you know, it's funny. I think all kids probably rummage around in the glove boxes of cars and wonder how the heck all that stuff got in there. And it's terrific to me at the very end where she talks about how she hid in the glove box pretending to be directions.
Yeah.
You know, every kid wants everything to turn out right and to go in a good direction and not to be lost. There's that fear of being lost.
And there's something in this poem that's very real to fear. I mean, Dad declares he knows by the spit and stripe of her this is no one of his own. His kids mope, and he goes.
He goes.
You can't tell from the buoyancy of the poem and the verve of it disguises this buried narrative at the end.
Which I guess maybe set her off to be a kind of poet or archivist in her life, where she talks about, you know, ear to ear, I must look lucky at last, a librarian at the Dictionary of Things looking up ever since,
yeah,
you know, and so on.
Yeah, terrific poem.
Yeah.
Also in the February issue, we have an essay by Durst Grünbein, one of Germany's best-known poets. He's the author of 6 volumes of poetry and a collection of essays.
Grünbein grew up in communist East Germany and is considered one of the most significant poets to emerge after reunification. This month, we feature an essay by Grünbein called Why Live Without Writing. It comes from a book of essays, The Bars of Atlantis, that will be published this spring by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
The essay was translated by poet Michael Hoffman, whose poems, essays, and translations appear often in Poetry Magazine. Hoffman translated Grünbein's 2005 poetry collection, Ashes for Breakfast. He joins us by phone from Florida to talk about Grünbein's essay. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Thanks for being with us today. I wanted to ask you first, this essay sort of it pivots on 3 questions. He says all poets are always asked the same 3 questions. One is, can you live off of it? And the second one is, how long have you been writing? And the third one is, why do you write? And the questions are, he doesn't really answer them. He sort of throws them up there, and then he goes in all kinds of different directions. Do you think that this is a different sort of essay, has a different flavor than the kind of things that an American or English writer would write?
Yes, I do. It's an odd experience translating Durst, because in the kind of things that I do under my own name, I think I represent this Anglo-Saxon principle of utility and occasion. And when I come across something like Durst, whom I know fairly well and like a very great deal, it's like meeting someone with infinite resources and infinite horizons. There is no particular occasion for this essay. It has this, in German, has this particularly beautiful title, Warum schriftlos leben? It is why live without writing, but the word schriftlos, without writing, is lovely. You know, here is somebody who trawls, you know, all of time, who talks about Plato and the Hyperboreans, who talks about himself, who talks about Proust, who quotes a whole poem of Basil Bunting's, you know, and I think most English poets wouldn't know the German equivalent or perhaps any foreign equivalent to Basil Bunting. So it's huge. I mean, I feel, you know, it's a little bit like getting a rope and going up Mount Rushmore.
You know, the essay addresses the 3 questions Chris gave us, but another one that poets are often asked is, what kind of poems do you write? And can you tell our listeners what kind of poems Grünbein comes up with?
He says in one of the essays, he says somebody gave him a copy of Ezra Pound when he was 17, and something caught. And so his first poems, Mornings in the Grey Zone, they're called, the Grey Zone, the Ostzone, the Eastern Zone, is East Germany. They're sort of sprayed across the page like the cantos are, with lots of fancy indentations and fancy breaks. And it's a very recognizable sort of series of Polaroids from East Germany, of tram rides, or another essay he talks about going up to this sort of toxic dump all the time, because that's sort of what the place offered. And then through unification, Durst did get this reputation for being the significant German poet after unification. But he wasn't a poet of unification. He wasn't going to sing the joys of amalgamation. And I think what he did then was he slightly wanted to take himself off the contemporary menu. And he sort of rediscovers himself as a classicist. So he often writes about ancient Mediterranean cultures. He says somewhere that his most contemporary experience is seeing the ruins of Pompeii in Herculaneum. So there's something really sort of perverse and self-denying and something formidable about him. He's sort of making himself sort of indigestible or not easily digestible. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that's very clear. You know, and more than once in the essay, Grunewald compares the poet to a prisoner, in fact,
yeah.
And it's usually more funny than bitter, you know, when he does it. At one point he says, a poor fellow on day release from his cell in solitary confinement, whose messages are like little crumpled scraps of paper that pass from hand to hand in prison. Do you get this wry humor from him in person and in the poems as well?
Yeah. I think the first time I ever had to write something about him after I'd met him for the first time in 1990 or something like that was I talked about his giggle. He does have a lovely, infectious sense of humor. You know, there is something very, very pleasantly twisted about him.
Yeah. This essay is written as a kind of indirect memoir, and Grunewald writes in the third person about the poet throughout, but it's pretty clear that he's drawing on personal experience, or at least it certainly seems like he is.
Yeah.
Did you ever talk to him about that choice of not writing in the first person, or did you ever have any insight on that?
I mean, I would put it with the sort of the gestures of refusal or of making oneself difficult to sort of be eaten, so to speak, by our kind of voracious society, literature. I think it is him, and he's not denying that it's him. But he's extrapolating, or he's generalizing. And as I say, he has this aptitude as to fall through time, where the reading has ended. He's just obviously given a reading, but suddenly we flash back 2,000 years, and there's a crowd of people in togas are just dispersing. But I think he feels it like that. He feels there is no difference, that it might as well be then, that nothing has changed. And one of the other things he says is just how old poetry is. And he says, the person in the corner of the cave who can't hunt for one reason or another, but who keeps the hunters amused when they come home.
That sounds connected with his idea that poetry holds a paradoxical place in culture of simultaneously being at the heart of everything while standing off to one side as a kind of... testimony
that's right.
Or observer.
That's right. Mm. That's right.
He says that poets can relax and leave unanswered the third question of this essay, which is why write poetry. But he does sort of give it an answer in the end. He says to escape sheer dread of the present and to be more complete or less ghostly, because the brain is a wilderness and writing extends the real by a dimension or two. I'm paraphrasing there at the end. What do you think of that answer?
I mean, I think the brain answer is true. I think he has an uncommonly big and interesting and well-stocked brain. I mean, he knows more stuff than anybody I've met, I think, from hard science to contemporary art. And I think it's... I would think that as him, he's probably always sort of finding a way of tunneling out of himself.
It's different than what you hear, though, because you hear that poetry is a way of seizing the present, seizing the moment, and this seems to be... He's saying it's a dread of the moment.
The dread of being shut in the moment, we think in these sort of peremptory historical moments, like the coming down of the Berlin Wall, we're apt to think that this is history. But actually, Dorsey always remembers that history has been going on a long time, and that things don't acquire their importance till much later.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Michael.
Stay well. Bye bye.
Bye. Michael Hoffman's selected poems is out now from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
You can read his translation of Durst Grunewald's essay and everything else you've heard on this program in the February issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman, edited by Sarah Campbell, and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.